Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Little Humans. As always, I am your co-host, Paul David.
And I'm William Gadsby-Pete, your other co-host.
Today, we're talking about DEI, which for folks don't know, it's diversity, equity, and inclusion. AI, if you really don't know, artificial intelligence, and diversity washing with Dr. Sarah Saska, co-founder and CEO of Femininity. Welcome to the show.
Hi, all. I love the name, so I know I'm in the right spot.
And you're calling in from Toronto today, is that right?
Yep. Cool. Nice and snowy.
Is it snowy? Okay.
Right. Oh, awesome.
So today we're going to just dive in and kind of talk about what Dr. Saska does, running a full service DEI consulting firm that helps companies build more diverse and equitable workplaces and products. Dr. Saska is a researcher and an IDEA, that's an inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility practitioner whose experience spans, and this is my dream brand to work for, NASA. I just watched the A Million Miles Away movie with Michael Pena last night. It made me very happy. You've also worked with the Equality Fund and several academic institutions across Canada. We're very happy to have you on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
So just to kind of set the scene, wanted to give our audience a brief overview of diversity, equity, inclusion, why it matters. You know, we've talked about it a few times on this episode, but wanted to kind of set the broad scene and specifically as it relates to the tech community. And I know there's been a lot of like sort of backlash against the idea of DEI in the tech community, and wanted to get your lay of the land of kind of, you know, what is DEI and what's going on in that space right now?
Yeah, so... Not an uncomplicated question, and definitely depends. You're going to get many answers, right? Depending on who you ask right now. I guess like at the most brass tacks, right? The field of DEI very much stems from, you know, the civil rights movement in the United States, the 1950s, 60s, and so forth. And I'd say different countries around the world have their sort of iteration, their version of it that has stemmed from different sort of historical moments, different points of sort of social movements, injustice, and so forth. So it doesn't look the same across countries, that's for certain. Although it seems like whenever we talk about it right now, we're talking about it in the frame of North America, likely the United States, right? Is that kind of the safe assumption for right now? So, I mean, at the most fundamental level, right? The most basic business case shows us that companies investing in DEI have better financial outcomes, they're more innovative, and so forth. But that's boring. We've been sort of resetting and replicating that for, I don't know, the better part of two decades. I'd say, you know, in 2024, it's really going to, the reason someone is going to care about DEI or not is really a function of where they sit. So why DEI matters depends on a leader's position, their worldview, their values, their perspectives, and so forth, right? So many variables. And I kind of think of the reasons right now about why it matters to leaders in about four different buckets generally. So I'd say like there's the first bucket are those leaders who've simply been pushed into it. They might say they've been bullied, forcibly so, whatever it may be, but they've been pushed into it due to boards or external pressure, something like that. And then the second sort of group are folks, leaders, organizations, they're really scared and they realize they actually really need help, right? They're scared of lawsuits. They want to mitigate risk. They know that on any given day, there's all these new forms of crises and forms of uncertainty that are just cropping up, right? From climate disaster to people's mental health, to the effects of colonialism and imperialism. Or they know that workplaces and workforces just continue to get more and more diverse, whether they've been trying to hire in that manner or not. And diversity is actually really hard to manage because diversity literally means difference. And, you know, it's actually a lot of work to have a lot of different people with a lot of different values and perspectives and needs to come together within a business to actually do good work together, right? It requires a lot of effort to lead that well. And I'd say that sort of the other big bucket for me are leaders and companies that want to sell more things. Right? They know that consumer markets demand adaptive, inclusive, and sustainable products, right? The one size fits all sort of approach notion is very antiquated. And they're trying to do really cool things, right? Like, so Newark Airport designed a sensory room for neurodiverse and autistic travelers. And we're watching the boom of the hands-free shoe market, right? That very much comes from innovation within the disability community sort of originally. And then we're seeing the utility just sort of scale more broadly. We're watching Netflix invest like over somewhere over $2 billion in literally Korean dramas, right? Because they're trying to navigate their sort of foothold in this ever-evolving market. And they were watching just the increased mainstreaming and commercialization of Black-owned beauty brands that are continuing to fill a gap in markets, you know, in the beauty industry that just sort of ignored melanated skin for decades upon decades. So yeah, sell more things. So I'd say those are sort of the buckets that I really think about.
Do you think it is just that complexity of managing across different backgrounds that is where a lot of the resistance to DEI comes from? Because I mean, like, the business case has been kind of pretty settled scientifically for 20-30 years. You get have a more diverse team, you get better outcomes both in terms of productivity and finance. So do you think that's the main blocker and the driver of maybe, I mean, obviously there's also a huge amount of politics around it, but some of the stuff we are seeing in North America where there does seem like a real backlash against DEI, both in you know, the political space, but also some big companies, is it just it's difficult, so people find it's easier to just kind of like poo-poo the whole thing rather than kind of go with it, work through that hard graft you have to do to actually implement a truly diverse company culture?
I don't think that's like the cause of the backlash. I don't think like people who want to build really interesting things in the world and, you know, work really hard or are scared of difficult or challenging things. I think there's some more sort of fundamental pieces going on with this backlash right now. Like, I guess for me, there's sort of like two sort of big variables maybe. So when like Elon says something like DEI must die, well, you probably wouldn't expect me to say this. I can kind of get maybe 80-90% of the way there with him in terms of sort of his critique, his issues and so forth. But we diverge in some points of his, you know, his analysis and therefore like the result and outcome that he wants, right? So for me, I think like DEI in its current iteration probably needs to die, right? We need to do a heck of a lot better, but that's because I want it to continue, right? I believe in, you know, this as a field of practice and the utility and the benefit and all those sort of things. But I think the way things are sort of playing out and the way that work is being done right now are sort of a big variable that we need to, you know, really talk about.
What are the issues there in your experience where the current format just isn't enough?
So I'd say, you know, having been in this space for like the better part of, I guess, 2 decades sort of at this point, like when we first started, we're Toronto-based, Canadian-based, we couldn't even work in the Canadian market. We had to look elsewhere to even find business. But I'd say, you know, after the murder of George Floyd, right, a number of years ago in the North American context, there was just a really stark rise in DEI practitioners, right? DEI practitioners sort of popped up overnight. Suddenly everyone and their mother was a DEI leader on LinkedIn simply because they changed the, you know, their title in LinkedIn to say so. And it effectively became the wild, wild west. And I'd say there's a reason for that. And that's because we haven't, as an industry, gotten really clear on what are the skill sets, forms of experience, and so forth that are required to be an effective practitioner. And, you know, after the rise in DEI leaders, after the murder of George Floyd, with the rise of BLM in workplaces, we witnessed a lot of tokenized hiring, right? So a lot of organizations would look around and say, where is my most senior, experienced, whoever it may be, racialized employee? And they put them into that role. And bless their heart, while the intentions were good, they didn't set these people up for success, right? They didn't have robust budgets. They didn't have a good team. They weren't supported. And so they ultimately set them up for failure. Then what did we see, you know, about 6 months later? We saw really high churn rates, right? Folks were leaving the field left and right. And then it gave folks who are skeptics, critics of the field and the field of practice, a lot more ammunition to believe, hey, I told you this didn't work. Here we go.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear a bit more about your experience in the tech space in general. You've got some pretty remarkable institutions on your client list, ranging from Shopify to Google, Ubisoft, and add Zendesk to that. In the tech space, like, what do you think are the sort of stickiest bits when it comes to DEI? And like, you know, are those bits like unique to tech and unique to some of the personalities we see in tech, unique to some of the strategies that tech companies try to employ to sell their products? Or do you think it's more cross-cutting? Is there some special sauce to the way DEI is rolling out or not rolling out in the tech space right now?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think for me, fundamentally, like, there's a lot of different ways you can answer this question, right? You know, it's the move hard, move fast, break things, you know, like all those sort of ethos of like scale, dream big, do things, have big, sort of big effects. There's a lot of critique in all of that. But I think for me, one of the biggest pieces is that we're still sort of, the tech sector sort of writ large, still functioning under this idea that technology is somehow more objective than humans, and that they're sort of these distinct things. Like we're still, you know, like we always talk about like the mind body, like split, like disassociating these things. We're still disassociating like technology from the humans. And I think that conversation's gotten better in the last few years, but I don't think we've really closed the gap, right? So we're still viewing big data and analytics and predictive algorithms as somehow more objective than humans, and therefore better able to make more objective decisions and shape our collective future, shape our workplaces and so forth. And we're still disassociating people's role in the design of technology.
That's a really good segue onto the questions I really want to ask you is like, in your space at the cutting edge of true DEI, what are you seeing in terms of AI? Like, you know, one of the big scary things that always gets covered in the media is like, you know, AI will sort of underline bias in humans and enshrine it in sort of code. Is that something you're seeing the tech sector be mindful of and trying to address? Like, what do you think AI will ultimately be like kind of a net positive for DEI?
Yeah, so that, I think that's a really interesting question, actually. So as we're witnessing organizations realize that they need to actually use AI to scale and operationalize their businesses, because if they don't, their competitors are going to, I think this is actually a really special moment for organizations to take the design of those protocols and guidelines of how to scale the usage of AI within their business and put it under the DEI function, because doing so isn't inherently tied to technical skill sets. Like you need to understand it just as you need to understand at a high level how to code if you want to be able to, you know, advise someone to design something for you. But it's not inherently technical, and it's a lot more tied to ethics and accountability and responsible use of the tools and the functions. So I think, you know, we have all these really legitimate fears about scaling bias and scaling discriminatory systems. So why don't we put this under the purview of DEI through the role in workplaces and do it with a ton of attention? And while we're at it, since there's dwindling budgets and we're witnessing, you know, chief diversity officers and related roles be laid off, why don't we actually have these same folks figure out how to leverage AI in a really intentional and meaningful way to actually scale DEI to try to create some more resilience and sustainability around the field of practice within the workplace?
Like Paul said, your kind of roster of clients in tech is pretty much a who's who of beer. Are you seeing that approach amongst some of those larger tech companies, or is there anyone kind of leading the way in regards to that kind of philosophy?
Right now, it feels like no. I think that, again, there's still this sort of gap that somehow this rollout is highly technical, and that there's some sort of bias that like chief diversity officers or related roles are not technical folks. Neither of those statements are true. Right. And like anything, the companies in the world that have done the best with DEI efforts, maybe they have a chief diversity officer, unclear. But what they do have is a decentralized force of folks who have integrated DEI competencies as a field of practice into their role. And it's, you know, it's touching sort of every piece of the business, you know, like octopus tentacles. And those are the ones who have resilience. So the model would be to use the way that DEI touches every part of a business to scale AI in a meaningful way too, right?
Yeah. I'm glad you touched on the technical bits of DEI, because I think that's like a really interesting space. And there's this you know, well-known article by Lily Zhang in the Harvard Business Review from 2022 about, you know, the failure of the DEI industrial complex. People love to put industrial complex on tash of something
totally
that they don't like.
Totally.
But you know, I think in that piece, she kind of delves into the idea of like finding the right specialists and, you know, focusing on understanding outcomes as important. So like there's an element of this that's the DEI profession growing up, you know, before our eyes and becoming more, you know, sophisticated. So super curious to hear where you stand on that, like, and how you and the work you're doing at Feminuity are trying to improve the professionalization and sophistication of DEI as a practice.
Totally. Yeah. I think that's, for us, it's basically just always been top of mind, right? Like we came into this industry when they weren't just naysayers. Like, it wasn't like a hot moment where people were critiquing the field and trying to, you know, tell it must die. It was just a non-issue, a non-topic, right? So we were literally in boardrooms just trying to get companies to understand why the heck they would want to give us just a dollar and a moment of their time. And so for us, we always had to tie it to a ton of rigor, to really robust methodologies and theoretical frameworks and really clear data systems. And I'd say the sort of the average DEI practitioner, they don't tend to speak the language of data or technology or other sort of quantifiable pieces that are just so critical. So I think that's a big one. Other sort of big factors that I think really are sort of going to be important for practitioners to really think about and what we're really driving towards are, I'd say, a competency-based approach to DEI. So I think this really helps to sort of solve for some of the issues with the quote-unquote Wild West that is the field and sort of who constitutes and who qualifies as legitimate to lead this work. I also think tying DEI to a competency-based approach actually helps us to cut through divide, right? It helps us to sort of transcend political and ideological divides and actually just ground it in really, really core sort of competencies.
Can you break that down for our audience? Because like I used to work in education. And I helped start some high schools that were competency-based learning institutions, right? So I love that you're taking us into that terrain. But I think a lot of folks might not know what competency-based means. My understanding of it is it's about, you know, skills and mindsets and habits and behaviors that we want people to embody. So just, yeah, if you could break the competency-based piece down in the context of DEI for our audience, I think that'd be great.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, Paul, you just said it here. And I say, you know, if a company is hiring for their DEI lead, get really clear on what type, what's the flavor of DEI that you're actually trying to solve for. Is your focus product inclusion? If so, product inclusion and the related sort of skill sets and competencies to that are going to be critical for you to look for as you're hiring. I think figuring out what your end goal is as a company, and you don't need to do it all, right? Being more clear and more sort of focused is actually, I think, much more beneficial than just sort of adopting sort of a generic approach to DEI, because it's tied to your mission, your vision, your values, and then you can align it to your business strategy overall. So I'd say once you get really clear on that, then break down, well, if the focus is product inclusion, okay, cool. What do we need from this person? Well, they're going to need to have some technical expertise. They're going to need to be, you know, well-versed in accessible design and inclusive design and product inclusion. They're going to need to be well-versed in change management and, you know, being a translator to talk across various teams and help their tech folks actually build bridges and understand folks across different departments in a more meaningful manner, right? So break down what are the skill sets that are required for all of that. And those are sort of the competencies that you need.
We've done some work with specifically in the world of racial equity in the States, and every single person who worked there was just an academic. Like, they were just like such a scientific academic mind to everything. And yeah, or had all at some point worked in education as well in the States. So I think there's a huge overlap in that. And that's almost like real people that are actually working on the issue rather than kind of like some of the, you know, flash in the pan that we saw overnight from the quote unquote Wild West. Would love to just hear a bit about specifically Femenuity and how some of the projects that you've worked on, some of your big successes, and how you kind of apply that legitimate sort of framework and methodology to your work to drive awesome results for, you know, that roster of incredible clients we already spoke about.
Yeah, I think, you know, a big piece of, I think, why we've had certain clients for 5, 6, 7 years, you know, at this point, which I'd say is, you know, maybe not quite the norm for a lot of companies at this stage, is because we really understand. We get in there and understand the constraints of the business, right? What's feasible, what's not. We get clear on what an organization's theory of change actually is. I think that's sort of probably one of the most critical things to do from the start, right? There are so many beautiful ways to create and affect change in this world, but what that actually looks like and translates to in the workplace needs to be a little different, right? But still, different workplaces have different sort of frames on what that looks like. So we get clear on what their capacity is, what their sort of will and desire and their resources are, and we design and work with them to meet that need. I think it's also really important that we're also really cognizant of the context that we're working with them and that they're working within more broadly. So we steer away from sort of pie in the sky, fluffy kind of bullshit, you know, recommendations or approaches. What's really important is to understand what are their HR constraints and needs, what type of employment and labor law systems are they working within, what type of regulatory systems are they working within, because they're a company that has to fulfill and adhere to all these broader systems. So we have to make sure that the recommendations and the work we're doing with them, that when it actually, you know, hits the ground, can actually break through, right? It has to work across those systems. And I'd say that's one of the biggest things that doesn't allow things to stick or gel, right? Why so many strategies sort of sit on the shelf and, you know, digitally collect dust over time, because they just don't work when the rubber hits the road, right? And the other big thing is we create really robust decentralized models. So even if there's a chief diversity officer with a small team, we make sure that we're actually scaling the field of practice across the business, so that, you know, if you do come to a point where an organization is laying off their lead roles in those teams, that there's a stickiness, right? That sort of keeps some things intact. And I think that's really where, you know, we're moving to overall in this field.
If you can, just maybe a specific project or client, like just the kind of start to finish and the impact that you've had.
Totally. Yeah. So I'd say like the decentralized sort of model system, we built squads with a really, you know, prominent sort of media company in the Canadian context. And so they have 17 different squads that sit across different sort of functions of the business. Each squad has a clear set of DEI competencies that they are responsible for, that they are responsible to continue to upskill with, that they are responsible to scale and drive across the business. And even in the midst of actually them going through layoffs and all those kind of things, their squads are still deeply intact and functioning, right? And they would be a great example of a company that's been trialing different types of AI sort of to automate and take a lot of at least the administrative labor out of scaling their DEI efforts in light of, you know, just not having enough time and resources.
Curious to hear a bit more about your specific journey and like in coming to found Feminuity. You've done your research on kind of the need for companies in the technology and innovation space to kind of center around ethical and equitable design. That was part of your inspiration for it, but would love to hear, you know, your experiences in those, you know, with that, you know, doctoral research in these workplaces, how it all led to you designing the consultancy that you did.
Yeah, it's always a fun question. Makes me feel like time has really passed when I think about it. So when I was in my PhD, I learned that car accidents are the leading cause of death related to maternal trauma. So translation, when someone who is pregnant gets into a car crash, there's a really high likelihood that they'll lose the unborn fetus. And of course, I was curious, and you know, when you really sort of dig around, what becomes really, really clear is that this is literally just due to really antiquated practices in the automotive industry that are very much the norm. And so that norm is designing vehicles using 180-pound male frame as the default, the norm, and then designing cars, building cars around that, right? And this is very much scaled across the board. And so at the time, I thought, well, who are the like most leading, fascinating players in the automotive industry? And, you know, Tesla was very much coming up at that time. And as I dug a little further, it just became clear that while they were so new and novel and like really pushing for progress in so many interesting aspects, they were still using this really antiquated piece from the automotive industry sort of as a whole. And so from there, I just started to look around to different fields, different sectors, and it kind of grew from there, right? It just became clear that at the end of the day, it's the people who design the products, the services, the things that we use and touch in the world. And so while our focus has always been on the output, it's the people who shape the product. So we very quickly realized we had to build a full sort of practice around the people side of things as well.
You've written a couple of really interesting reports about, you know, like the tech community in Canada. And, you know, just curious to hear like what your prescription is. Like if you could sort of wave a magic wand, like what do you feel like the tech community, particularly in Canada and North America, what are they needing? What are the sort of top two or three priorities as it relates to like tech and DEI right now?
Yeah, I guess magic wand waving, that's always a fun question. You know, I feel like I spent the last 10 years at least, really just pushing for tech to slow down. right? We were just moving ahead so aggressively in the name of quote unquote progress, driving and pacing towards a sort of radical uncertainty when we don't know how this is going to net out for folks. And so I would really just love tech to actually pause, slow down. I know it's not realistic in a capitalist frame and system with, you know, all these sort of variable pressures. I know that's not the case. So I doubt that will happen. So I think I've learned to just get really clear on, okay, cool. So how can we help shape it, right? How can we sort of help shape things in real time? And I'd love to see a lot more intentionality around ethical, responsible and accountable AI protocols and a standardization across the board, especially as they're translated into workplaces. I think that's a really sort of key conversation. And I don't feel like there's a lot of like, well, there's so much brilliance, so much thoughtful leadership around working to set these protocols, how they get scaled across countries and governing systems, and then translated in the workplace. I think there's going to be a lot of gaps there that we need to really get clear on.
And one thing we like to always end on too is just like, you know, a little bit of advice and any lessons that you've learned, you know, from your time doing this work. What sort of guidance would you give to other practitioners out there who are looking to make their mark in the DEI meets tech space, and just any nuggets of wisdom you've learned along the way?
I guess I'd say be orthogonal and intersectional and interdisciplinary and multidisciplinary in your approach, right? Because as we still stay in this moment of who constitutes, qualifies, who can lead this work, to me, the most fascinating and effective practitioners are those who truly have a wildly diversified skill set. You know, they've got their fingers in many sort of cookie jars, and they continue to be curious. And humility is just so key, right? There is no absolute sort of truth, I think, you know, such as life, like getting beyond the binaries, right? Playing in that sort of gray, opening space for nuance, I think is one of the most critical skill sets that you can have in this space. So if you want to be an effective leader, coming in with like a really righteous absolutist approach, I don't think it serves anyone well. And I don't think it's how you're going to actually have folks be able to lead folks in a meaningful way either, right? Because you really need to create space, create a broader container for those across an organization.
Yeah,
we've certainly experienced some of that in the absolutist approach. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Before we wrap up, I'd love just if you'd let our guests know, I guess, let our audience know even, where they might be able to find out more about yourself, your personal journey, and then also about Femininity as well, and if they're looking for any of those services or resources or any of those reports that Paul mentioned.
Yeah, sure. So you can learn more about our business, our team, our awesome team of folks at www.feminui.org. Yeah, I'm constantly sharing my hot takes and intentional critiques of this space, I'd say, on LinkedIn and other places. So Dr. Sarah Saska.
We love a hot take. That's what we're all about.
Yes, we do. It makes marketing easier.
Hot tech takes would be the second name of this podcast we could do it.
We could change it. Well, this has been a fantastic episode of the podcast that will soon be known as Hot Tech Takes, but is still currently known as Tech Can't Save Us. And yes, I was going to ask about Gordon. Is this Gordon?
No, this is Cat with No Name, who is Gordon's new sibling.
Oh, how new are we talking?
Pretty new. He's a baby Maine Coon.
Wow.
I thought it was a Maine Coon. Those of you who can't see, this gorgeous ginger Maine Coon cat was just on screen for a little bit. So
we'll make sure we get that in the promo clips there. But yeah, we're excited. And is Gordy doing well? Right, Gordon? Is it Gordon?
Gordy is doing well. Okay, yep. Thanks for asking.
Yeah.
I think you named the cat after another iconic, famous Canadian musician. Actually, he's named after Gord Downey, who's the lead singer of the Tragically Hip.
Yep.
Do you all know the Tragically Hip? I feel like they didn't break out of the Canadian walls.
So. I just did my research for the pod. That's how I know the Tragically Hip, but now I do know them. So.
So funny.
Yeah. Well, this has been another great episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. We've had the fantastic Dr. Sarah Saska, the co-founder and CEO of Femininity. They're doing really impressive work in the tech space and even more broadly when it comes to DEI. We spoke today about DEI, AI, and diversity washing. So we want to thank you so much for your time, Dr. Saska.
Awesome. Thanks for holding this space for these kind of conversations. They're super important.
You bet. And as always, please smash that subscribe button. Give us at least 5 stars for the work that we do here to bring on great guests like Dr. Sarah Saska. And we'll see y'all next week. Thanks so much, everybody.